I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a time in the state's history that was both closed down and wide open. We're going to discuss an exhibition at the Indiana State Museum, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. We're going to talk about a time of flappers, speakeasies, bootleggers, suffragists, and temperance activists. My guests will be three experts from the museum: Susanna Kerber, Senior Vice President of Collections and Interpretation; Rebecca Smith, Public Programs Developer; and Carrie Miller, Manager of Public Programs. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indiana State Museum's exciting new exhibit, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, which is, I gather, just a blockbuster. It's like 5,000 square feet. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are three people who are well-versed in this, starting with Susanna Kerber, who is the Senior Vice President of Collections and Interpretation and Curator for American Spirits; Rebecca Smith, who is the Public Programs Developer and the lead on all American Spirits public programming; and Carrie Miller, who is the Manager of Public Programs. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Certainly. Well, tell me a little bit about this exhibit, this exhibition first. And then I think probably I've always been fascinated by that whole era in American history. I'm probably going to dive down into that and get your thoughts on that. But tell me a little bit about, Susanna, I'll start with you, about what this exhibition is.
Sure. The exhibition was organized by the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and it's the first comprehensive exhibition on prohibition, its causes, what happened during that almost 14-year period when prohibition was in effect and what led to its downfall. So there's a lot of really fascinating material, everything from how the constitutional amendments that made prohibition possible were passed to, as you mentioned, a lot of the cultural trends that came out of that period. And we're still living with a lot of changes that came out of that period today.
What are some of those changes?
Well, they range from some of the constitutional precedents that were set during that period that have been going in and out of the courts ever since. I think people sometimes don't realize that things like the 7-year period for passing an amendment, that came in with the 18th Amendment, or for ratification, rather. Things like rulings on wiretapping, privacy, warrants, a lot of those precedents were set when there were attempts for law enforcement to battle organized crime. And then there are a lot of social changes. Some of those were underway already with World War I and sort of the beginning of the 20th century. But the way men and women socialized together, drinking in public, a lot of our attitudes towards alcohol, those really, you can see the direct connections to prohibition and its aftermath.
Rebecca, what am I going to find in this exhibit? If I go, what am I going to find there?
Well, just all of the things that Susanna just outlined, but we will also be having a wide variety of programs that will be associated with the exhibition, starting with a celebration of the 20s, which will be on September 20th, so not this Saturday, but the next. And people will, it's a family-friendly event, and people will be able to come in and learn a little bit about the pop culture from that period. They might be able to learn the Charleston from Naptown Stomp. We are partnering with them. They can learn some jazz music from the time. We're working with Jaden Street Jazz, a little bit about the 18th and 21st Amendments. And then throughout the course of the exhibition, we have a lot of other programs coming up, including one on the rise of craft beer in Indiana, which is a hot topic right now. Mm-hmm. Also, a program on Indiana's blue liquor laws that we are still debating today. And something as simple as a 1920s radio hour just for your entertainment.
So, and Carrie, if I do come to this, I mean, when are the times that the exhibition is open to the public? Is there a cost? What are the costs? And if people are making up their minds, is there a URL that they can find?
Absolutely. You'll find information on the museum's website at indianamuseum.org. And some of our special programming that Rebecca mentioned does require a registration, such as our Rise of Craft Beer in Indiana. Seating will be limited for that one because of the panel of authors that we have. The location for that is actually at the Tow Yard Brewery, so seating is limited. So there will be a registration that we ask people to call the museum at 317-232-1637.
Go ahead and give them that again.
317-232-1637. If you're interested in hearing our panel of fine authors discuss the rise of craft beer in Indiana, we'd love to have you join us. And that is actually October 23rd from 6 to 7 at the Tow Yard Brewery in downtown Indianapolis.
How long will this exhibition be here as part of it? Carrie, I'll stay with you.
Oh, that's all right. It stays with us through February 15th.
Okay, so people have a few months to get to it if they choose to, right?
Yes, and the nice thing about our programming is that it's sprinkled all throughout. So we have opening day programming on September 20th. Okay. We have two events in October, the Indiana Spirits and the Rise of Craft Beer. We have the Hoosier Blue Laws that will take place in January, right before the exhibition closes, and student programs that will be held throughout the run of the exhibition as well. So we'll keep it going for sure.
We are talking about Prohibition in anticipation of a new exhibition at the Indiana State Museum, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI. So let's talk a little bit about Prohibition. Susanna mentioned it's a 14-year period in our history. We talk about what that time encompasses. I mean, it's really coming out of World War One, and it encompasses that entire period between World War One and the coming of the New Deal. Rebecca, you're nodding your head, so I'm going to let you start.
You know, I'm just actively listening.
Well, it's nice to be affirmed.
I'm going to let Susanna start with that,
okay.
Actually.
All right, Susanna.
Well, you're absolutely right that it's bookended by two very major events in this country's history, which actually played a role in both the rise and the downfall of Prohibition. The time period actually goes back much further. Temperance efforts had been going on pretty strongly for at least 60 years and had actually been generated by the really severe alcohol problem that existed in this country. I think we hit bottom about 1830 when the average per capita consumption was the equivalent of 90 80-proof bottles of liquor a year. We're at about a third of that today. So, you know, there were real very serious concerns. And so there were all kinds of efforts that rose and fall, kind of dipped during the Civil War and then started coming back up. And actually, women's suffrage is very much tied into this because a lot of the women who would fight for the vote actually got their start in the temperance movement and really learned how to organize there. And then they received support from men and from social groups that really wanted to see Prohibition passed because they thought women would vote for it wholesale. So you have this long period that leads up to the passage of the 18th Amendment. And when the 18th Amendment is passed, some people think, oh, it won't go through. And, you know, there's some debate about that. But then World War I is going on and the U.S. becomes more involved. And that tremendous anti-German sentiment, there'd always been an anti-immigrant and facet to the Dries, the people who supported prohibition, and the anti-German sentiment just sweeps the 18th Amendment in. On the other end of the spectrum then, and we can talk a little bit as we go on about why prohibition fell apart, but you have the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And with the Great Depression, you have, first of all, the need for a new source of income. One thing people may not realize is during this whole period of about 20 years going from 1913 to 1933, we actually saw the passage of 6 constitutional amendments, which was really unprecedented. And the first of those was actually the passage of the income tax, because you couldn't get rid of liquor and beer until you had something that would replace the excise taxes that had been in place since the Civil War and amounted to about a quarter of federal revenue. So you, by the Depression, your other sources of income have dropped, it's lost legitimacy, and people, frankly, are a lot more worried about the economics of the country than they are about this now thoroughly discredited amendment. And so the Depression really is the final blow to prohibition.
Well, and there's also that force. I mean, in some ways, you can look at the roots of modern organized crime and see them taking place, too, because making alcohol illegal suddenly created tremendous profit opportunities for people who weren't particularly interested in following the law.
It absolutely did. And you see that rise. I mean, there'd been organized crime before prohibition. But what happens is it becomes regional, national, international. It gets much more organized. You have, by the end of prohibition, these treaties where different gangster groups get together and say, well, this is how we'll divide up the territory. And you see a rise in violence because of that. I think murder and assault goes up from a little under 12 per 100,000 people to 16 by the end of prohibition, and then drops down to about 10 by 1940. You see very strange partnerships where, for example, bootleggers are supporting dry politicians because they don't want to see the legal competition come back. Mm-hmm. And then you have the rise of law enforcement efforts to combat the organized crime, which, and all of this is dealt with in the show. So this is when warrantless wiretapping comes into place against the Seattle bootlegger Roy Olmsted. The Supreme Court upholds it. That won't be overturned until many, many decades later. So you have just a whole raft of landmark sort of civil rights kinds of civil liberties kinds of rulings that also come out as part of this law enforcement battle.
Well, and really, you alluded to this, but the emergence really of the FBI is a national force too, because even though J. Edgar Hoover was not exactly the cop he pretended to be, the super cop he pretended to be, he was much more of a bureaucrat and political infighter. He was able to leverage a lot of that to grow a huge, what amounted to a national police force.
Well, he was. And actually, a lot of prohibition enforcement also came out of Treasury. What's interesting is also that this period has such popular resonance that a lot of our FBI images of you know, the sort of Elliot Ness kind of images actually come out later in the 1950s, 1960s, and maybe give the FBI a little bigger role than they had.
We are talking about prohibition and in advance of an Indiana State Museum exhibition called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881, or you can send us an email at nolimits at WFYI.org. Susanna, you'd alluded to the fact that the temperance movement was actually much more complex than people understood. And I think in this context, because the popular perception, I think, is that these were just a group of kind of moralistic scolds at the time. And it really was a discussion about all sorts of behaviorals associated with drinking, including one that, we're talking about right now, to some degree, domestic violence. That was one of the concerns at the time. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Domestic violence and the whole range of limitations that women face. They couldn't own property. They couldn't divorce. They couldn't, if their husband was drinking away all of the family resources, they had no recourse, and they needed political power to address that.
And in part, though, they obviously needed to get, since they didn't have the votes themselves, how did they begin to put together the political machinery to get prohibition into the amendment process?
Sure. There were groups that were specific to the women's movement, like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, that start out in the 1870s, but it's really with the Anti-Saloon League, which is not just women, that things take off. That's founded in 1893 and has a man named Wayne Wheeler at his head, who just proves to be a master of political manipulation, really the Karl Rove of his day.
That's a great jump-off point for us to pick up the conversation on the other side. We are talking about American Spirits, the Rise and Fall of Prohibition, an exhibition at the Indiana State Museum. My guests are Susanna Kerber, Rebecca Smith, and Carrie Miller from the museum. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Prohibition in anticipation of the opening of the Indiana State Museum's blockbuster exhibition, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. My guests are Susanna Kerber, who is the Senior Vice President of Collections and Interpretation and Curator for American Spirits, Rebecca Smith, who is public programs developer and the lead on All American Spirits public programming, and Carrie Miller, manager of public programs. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about some of these unlikely partnerships that helped make Prohibition a political reality. Could you talk a little bit more about that, Susanna?
Sure. The partnerships and again, the Anti-Saloon League under Wayne Wheeler really pulled these groups together were people who probably would not have gotten along together in the same room. So you had, as we've mentioned, suffragettes, the women who were working for the vote. You had people who were motivated mostly by religion, especially within the Baptist and Methodist communities, because certainly that split along religious and ethnic lines, with, for example, Catholics and Lutherans tending to be on the wet or anti-prohibition side. You had progressives who thought that government really had a role to play in making people's lives better. You had populists who wanted to see things like an income tax be the source of wealth or of federal funding, and who really had a little bit of a soak it to the rich impact. You had nativists who were anti-immigrant and saw this as a way to keep America from being run into the ground by these European immigrants who were coming in large numbers at the time. You had groups like the Klan. The Klan took a very moralistic view and was very much in support of prohibition. So all of these groups together really fought within their own constituencies for prohibition, and the Anti-Saloon League made sure that these messages were getting out and really focused on this one issue to try to push it onto the national agenda and keep it there.
You mentioned the fact, obviously, we've talked about this kind of at the national level. What kind of impact did it have here in Indiana? Because, you know, at least here in Indiana, if we have a national reputation for that era, it is that we became the only state in the country where the Klan managed to gain significant influence and perhaps control over state government. Are there other ways that we saw changes brought on by Prohibition?
Sure. And Indiana had actually been toying with Prohibition for a while. And Governor Hanley, the Republicans tended to be more on the Prohibition side. The Democrats were divided, but were more likely to have a wet constituency. So you had Governor Hanley, for example, who had pushed through a prohibition law back in the early 20th century. You did have a lot of influence from the Baptists and especially the Methodists, who are a very strong religious group here in Indiana, mm-hmm. who pushed for prohibition. And you had figures like Billy Sunday, who was nationally known, who made Winona Lake his home, probably the most popular evangelist of the day and really someone who focused very heavily on the evils of drink. Former baseball player, probably over his career, reached about 100 million people, so wildly influential. Indiana, once we were in prohibition, actually took it farther than most states. We passed what was known as the Right Bone Dry Law. One thing you have to realize with the 18th Amendment is part of the reason it got through was because it was so vague. And then the Volstead Act was the congressional act that actually defined what the penalties were. The 18th Amendment, to appease people who were worried about states' rights, divided both the way that prohibition was enforced and some of those rules with the states and the federal government. So states had kind of a local option in how much they enforced or what they passed. Indiana really banned all uses of alcohol. There were exceptions within the Volstead Act for medicinal use, for example. Possession of alcohol was not illegal under the Volstead Act, but the Right Bone Dry Law made it illegal. So that actually things were much stricter. On the other hand, you had the Calumet region, which never went dry. The places like Du Bois County in southern Indiana, heavy German population, never really went dry. The resorts at French Lick were known for attracting people who were interested in drinking and gambling, including Al Capone, though I understand he wasn't welcome at some of the more reputable establishments there. So that you did have that same kind of ambivalence about prohibition in Indiana you had in other states.
We are talking about prohibition in anticipation of a blockbuster exhibition at the Indiana State Museum, American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Rebecca, you talk a little bit about how this exhibition takes me inside that era. And then I want to talk a little more widely about the contradictions, particularly in the popular perceptions of that era. But tell me how, if I go, I'm going to disappear back into the 1920s.
Well, there it starts in the 1830s, as Susanna said. Mm-hmm. So it goes over, again, what how much Americans were drinking. It takes you into a speakeasy at one point. It actually takes you into a church where you can become the evangelist or the temperance movement member.
Will I get to slide like Billy Sunday? Or
you can try. I don't know if there's enough room for all of that. But you can also, there's actually one portion in the speakeasy where you get a chance to try your hand at the Charleston. So there's no real instruction, but there are footprints on the ground. So if you're good with things like that, you can follow them along. So those are just some of the fun things that you can find within American Spirits.
And how did, we talk about this because, when we talk about the Volstead Act and the other laws that came along after the 18th Amendment, this sounds like a fairly repressive era. That's not the perception, though, in American memory of the 1920s. We consider that wide open, maybe in part because of some of the film treatments of The Great Gatsby, I suppose, that take a novel that's really about despair and make it somehow seem like a nonstop party. But could you talk a little bit about that, Susanna, about how we have, what the contradictions of the era were?
Well, the joke was that the dries had their law and the wets had their liquor, so everyone should be happy because alcohol was readily available to most people. However, you did see a drop in consumption by about 70% at the beginning of Prohibition, and then maybe by the end of the Prohibition, it was about down about 30% of where it had been. So it did have an impact because some people did feel like they needed to follow the law. And there were certainly people who genuinely believed in it, that the evil of alcohol needed to be eliminated. But then you did have a lot of what some contemporary folks referred to as institutionalized hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. It might be better to think of that in terms rather than repression in terms of the era where you were really forcing people into either following a law that they didn't necessarily agree with and that increasingly became out of line with social norms, or, you know, that they were going to decide to break the law. And that certainly had more dangers if you didn't have money. There were class differences, too. There were wood alcohol poisonings, mm-hmm. a lot of issues like that. It was certainly not safe to try to flaunt it unless you had a lot of money and a very reliable supplier. The other thing to really keep in mind about this period are those social changes then that came out of it, with men and women spending more time together. In some of the larger cities, you had what were called black and tans, where whites and blacks would hang out together socially, actually dance together. So you had some things that kind of loosened up the restrictions that people faced. On the other hand, you had, depending on where you lived, this whole concern about enforcement and what kind of penalties people who did break the law should suffer. And on the national level, that really intensified in 1929, when it hadn't been against the law to possess alcohol. But suddenly it became things that were misdemeanors under the Volstead Act became felonies. And if you didn't report any of these felonies, that itself was a felony. And some states began to pass more and more repressive laws, so that suddenly you could have somebody going to prison for years and years, maybe even for life, for relatively minor offenses. So it's this weird patchwork of, as you say, this image that we have of the flappers and the bootleggers and mm-hmm. things, but then also these enforcement efforts that the ASL really tried to stand. It's almost like they had kind of a body count of enforcement, and that was more important to them than whether the law was really effective. And it did impact a lot of people's lives.
One of the things that fascinates me that you've alluded to are the divisions along religious lines, too. Right in the middle of that era is the presidential campaign of 1928, which, you know, is the first time we have a Roman Catholic at the top of a presidential ticket. And that becomes a huge issue. And it's an issue, obviously, here in Indiana, because the Klan remained a powerful force and is probably, if Indiana's got a designated state historian, it's probably James Madison who makes the point that one of the misperceptions about that era in Indiana history is that the KKK wasn't all that focused on race. It was much more focused on religion, that they were much more concerned about Catholics than anything else and opposing them. Could we talk a little bit about the force that religion played in that era, what the divisions were there?
Sure. Again, a lot of it was along denominational lines. As I said, the Methodists and the Baptists were really in the forefront of the battle for prohibition and its enforcement. And in fact, the head of the Anti-Saloon League in Indiana was a Methodist minister named Edward Schumacher. And he was really a driving force behind some of the really punitive laws that were passed. The Catholic element, it's really interesting if you look at the presidential election of 28 and Al Smith versus Herbert Hoover, a lot of the prohibition rhetoric was a pretty thin disguise for anti-Catholic rhetoric.
Anti-Catholicism.
Well, there were sort of keywords that people would use, terms about Tammany Hall being wet, being sort of from this New York City, again, that sort of slur of an immigrant Catholic, not American kind of tag that they were really trying to attach to Al Smith. And so it's the language is used pretty consistently, while some particularly virulent people were very, very vocal that this was an Al Smith victory would mean that the papacy would be running the country. And there was a lot of really ugly propaganda. In other situations, there was a sort of subtle anti-Catholic piece, and then these code words that were used over and over again.
And how did that manifest itself here in Indiana?
Well, Al Smith didn't do well here, mm-hmm. as he really lost by a landslide in the U.S. as a whole. I think one of the really interesting things, though, that really leads to the downfall of prohibition, you would think this was the high point, and the Anti-Saloon mm-hmm. League certainly did, is if you look at this landslide for Al Smith, you look at in the same election for Congress, the dry candidates really dominated in Indiana and elsewhere. The prohibition forces thought this meant that they were golden. That's one reason they passed the 1929 law that was so punitive. But if you look at states that had referenda, and Indiana was not one of them, but some of our neighbors like Ohio and Michigan, I believe, were, that had referenda on prohibition-related issues in the same election, those referenda lost. So it wasn't really a vote necessarily for prohibition. Yeah. And the same thing in Indiana, we voted for repeal pretty readily. And so it was one of those things where that looked like the majority was dry, but maybe not so much.
Well, and how much of that is also the fact, and you've alluded to this too, that by winning that 1928 election so decisively, a lot of those candidates also put themselves in a position to be held almost exclusively responsible for the stock market crash in 1929 because there was no one else to blame at that point.
Excellent point. And really one reason that there had been several years of prosperity, the Republicans were going to do well in the 28 election, regardless of the Al Smith issues. So that's really what pushed them into office. So you're absolutely right. When the economy turns, so does the political tide. And while the Republicans by this time are very divided, in fact, there's a group of very prominent businessmen, mostly Republican, and a group of largely Republican society women who are actively campaigning against prohibition at this point, the Republicans are divided. The Democrats have gone pretty much wet. And so when they win in the subsequent elections, it changes the political calculus, and the 18th Amendment goes from something that looks unassailable to suddenly
something that's very vulnerable.
Exactly.
Yeah. We are talking about prohibition in anticipation of the Indiana State Museum's American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition exhibition. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Carrie, tell me something that will surprise me. If you're someone who has a less encyclopedic knowledge of prohibition than Susanna has, you come in there. What is something that will surprise me if I come to this exhibition about the era?
I don't necessarily have something that surprises you about the exhibition, but it's more of a social media program tactic that we are deploying. We are going to have a blog series that is all about the Jack Daniels conspiracy in Indianapolis.
What was the Jack Daniels conspiracy in Indianapolis?
For that one, I have to bounce it over to Rebecca.
All right, Rebecca,
she taught me everything I knew.
Okay.
So it was.
Not even going to ask what the research process was. Yeah, go ahead.
Carrie is actually deferring to me about a case that was heard here in Indianapolis at the U.S. District Court for Indiana by Judge Baltzall in 1926. And there was a big rum runner bust of George Remus, who was king of the bootleggers, and his cohorts.
Out of Cincinnati, right?
They actually, at this point, had purchased the rights to a Jack Daniels holding warehouse in St. Louis and came through, or busted in Indianapolis, and then the case was heard here.
But wasn't he the one who killed his somewhat estranged wife in Cincinnati?
Correct.
And that
actually happened after this big Jack Daniels case.
Because he ended up going to prison.
Correct.
Right? And
correct.
Yeah, there were all sorts of rumors about whether the wife was having an affair with, which leads one to believe that the past is every bit as complicated as the present is, that lives were just as messy then. So you'll be able, where will people find that part of the exhibition?
This is actually, as Carrie said, it's part of our social media campaign. So next week, the 1920s, for all intents and purposes, is going to be taking over our website and our Facebook page next week. So you will actually be able to learn about the case in four different spots, if you will. There is an actor who will tell you all about it. And it's a fascinating case.
We are talking about Prohibition in anticipation of the Indiana State Museum's American Spirits, the Rise and Fall of Prohibition exhibition. My guests, who are all from the museum, are Susanna Kerber, Rebecca Smith, and Carrie Miller. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Prohibition in anticipation of an exhibition at the Indiana State Museum, American Spirits, the Rise and Fall of Prohibition. My guests are Susanna Kerber, who is Senior Vice President of Collections and Interpretation and Curator for American Spirits, Rebecca Smith, who is Public Programs Developer and the lead on All American Spirits Public Programming, and Carrie Miller, who is Manager of Public Programs. I probably should say that our the other side of the WFYI operation, the television side, is going to be re-airing Ken Burns' documentary on Prohibition later this month on September 25th at 9 p.m. And I gather you have one of those, you know, 7 degrees of separation, or actually only 2 degrees of separation connections, Susanna, with the documentary.
That's right. Daniel Okrent, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist and who wrote a book called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, was the guest curator for the American Spirits exhibition, and he was also the consultant for the Ken Burns documentary. So there are a lot of nice parallels between the exhibition and the documentary series.
So it's not a bad thing. If you want to watch it in preparation for coming down or after you visit, it will help complete the education, I guess. This. I'd like to ask, what is the biggest, and I'm going to throw this one to you, Susanna, what is the biggest misperception Americans have right now about Prohibition?
I think it's really that set of images that people have in their minds that you alluded to at the beginning of the show about flappers and bootleggers and G-men and you know, these, and that it's this sort of fun, roaring 20s jazz age period. And all of that is true. I mean, sometimes the hardest stereotypes to get rid of are the ones that do have a basis in truth. It's just that it is so much more than that. And again, the ramifications of that are so much deeper. So I think it's really that whole roaring 20s, flappers, jazz age things. But it was something people were taking very seriously and had really huge political and social ramifications.
Well, and the fact that, you know, that period they associate almost without consequence, and yet mm-hmm. you look at the writers we most associate with that time period. Fitzgerald died at the age of 44, if I'm not mistaken, and Hemingway obviously committed suicide. Another writer who kind of celebrated that time period, Thomas Wolfe, didn't even make it to his 40th birthday. So we see that there were an awful lot of consequences actually for what was going on at that time. We've talked an awful lot about what brought Prohibition on. Can we talk some about the second part of that equation? I mean, obviously the crash of the stock market and the country's increasing focus on jobs, economic questions and all of that had some part in it, but I could also see how, you know, if you were trying to handle that as a political figure, you could say, all the more reason we need to be sober now. We all need to be working hard. We all need to be paying attention. You know, this just reemphasizes how desperately we need Prohibition. Why did it break down? I mean, we're talking about, from adoption to collapse, a fairly short period in American history.
We really are, and there are so many reasons that it broke down, and we've talked about a few of them. I think the biggest single cause is that it had lost all legitimacy, and it had lost that legitimacy really across all levels of society, from people in the working class, you know, every day, people who thought, you know, this might be a good thing for society and saw that all of the legal problems, who saw people's lives being broken apart by it, again, the kind of institutionalized hypocrisy. Government officials, for the most part, had given up, and at the state level, some of them had never tried to enforce it. I think one of my favorite facts is that at the end of Prohibition, that first day that alcohol was legal, Maryland dismissed its official bootlegger to their House of Representatives. So clearly some people took it more seriously than others from the beginning. But again, the upper classes, the Republican establishment for the most part, just really across the board said, you know, this is not working. We have to address this. You also have a change in the political climate, not just from Republican to Democrat, but the Anti-Saloon League really pushed to have this amendment passed before 1920 because they knew the reapportionment after the 1920 census would change everything. That you would have more power in states that had larger cities, had larger immigrant populations, and they were afraid that would doom it. And in fact, Congress sat on that reapportionment until 1929. Also, this is a period when in state legislatures, you didn't have the principle of one person, one vote. That doesn't really come until a Supreme Court decision in 1962. So they were largely dominated by rural and small town constituencies, which were much more likely to be dry. So when they put in the process for repeal, it's interesting. They do it by state convention, not by state legislatures, so that you get more of the reflection of, you know, we talked about how the referenda were being defeated. If they supported prohibition, while politicians were getting in who were dry, those conventions bypassed those state legislatures and really made it possible. So it's this whole process of societal changes, the loss of legitimacy, the depression, the need for the tax revenue, and then just the climate change in the politics of the time.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Evan, who says, I would like to know if your guests would comment on the current prohibition of marijuana in Indiana and the probability of it being lifted in the future. Thank you. I guess that whole question, obviously, we're seeing some parallels now in that the discussion about whether marijuana should be legalized, some places are, some places aren't right now, whether there are any parallels between that or any other thing that's going on, you know, in terms of prohibited substances in our society today, between that era and this one?
I think there is a tendency to want to draw that parallel between the two, to say it's prohibition of a particular substance. As we've been talking, the conditions for prohibition were so specific to the time, to the cultural trends, the political trends, that once you start digging into it, it's a lot harder to make that connection. Plus, alcohol had been such a part of everyday life for so long, you know, so the social effects of outlawing it, the expectations of people to be able to get it were, I think, in a very different place, too.
And I probably should have asked this question earlier, what accounted for that incredible dependence on alcohol? I mean, you're talking about three times consumption levels, current consumption levels back in the 1830s. Why was that?
Well, it's, and again, that fluctuates, but in the 1830s, you have a whole range of things from cultural norms. You have a lack of access to drinking water, clean drinking water. You have the fact that it's easier to transport your corn as whiskey than it is as grain that was driving some of this, and whiskey was the one of the predominant forms for that. You know, if you have fruit, you're probably preserving it as cider. That cider's going to last longer if it's, say, like 10% alcohol or something. And then with the rise of immigrant groups, you actually have an overall decrease in alcohol consumption through that whole period of the temperance debate. So it's not a matter of it just keeps going up or it's steady, but that had been dropping significantly. And you'd also had a shift over to beer. And part of that is driven by the immigrant population.
We are talking about prohibition here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey there, how you doing?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening. This is a great topic, and I had done some research myself, and I wonder if any of the ladies had ever read the Life and Times of the Late Great Demon Rum, which is a history of prohibition movements in North America, which I found years ago, and it's really great. It covers every state in the union. And another one other point was about the nativist sentiment. Mm-hmm. And the Klan is Grand Dragon, which was written by, I can't think of the guy's name, but he was a professor at Indiana State. But it's all about D.C. Stevenson and the depth and the of the nativist, anti-foreign, anti-Catholic sentiment at the time. And they're both very helpful in this conversation.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jack. I'll see if I can get you an answer.
All right, man.
Thank you. Susanna.
I've actually not read The Late Great Demon Rum. I've seen references to it, and we'll have to look that up, and have read the Grand Dragon book, and it is very illuminating in terms of that whole period and then the effect of the Klan's infiltration into government officials at the county, local and state levels, as well as then that really spectacular fall after D.C. Stevenson is convicted in 1925.
I mean, there's so many fascinating stories from that era. I mean, you've got the whole Scopes Monkey trial thing. You've got the summer. Bill Bryson just did a wonderful book just about the summer of 1927 and the many ways that transformed American culture. Yeah. And all of that, do you find yourself, when you're doing the research on this, just thinking, oh, there's a tangent I could follow for quite a while, but if I do, I'll be led astray. Susanna.
Oh, absolutely. And you can realize I'm somebody who reads Supreme Court cases for fun, so it's easy to get me off on a tangent.
I'm not sure whether that's admirable or a cry for help, Susanna. But anyway, we are talking about prohibition here on No Limits. Miles, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
Doing fine. What's on your mind?
I just wondered if you could explain what blue laws are and how if we're any closer to actually getting to where you can purchase beer on Sundays in Indiana.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Yeah, we can talk about the blue laws, Susanna. Or do you want to do it, Rebecca?
Yeah,
Rebecca.
I'll take that one. I'll approach that. First of all, I don't really have the authority to tell you, Miles, if we are any closer to being able to purchase beer on Sundays or spirits or wine. But as you've noted, it's something that is still a hot topic for today.
Keeps coming back in every legislative session.
Keeps coming back, yes, in Indiana specifically. Blue laws are, at one point, it was a religious prohibition religiously for religious purposes. Today we still refer to them as blue liquor laws. So that is the prohibition of purchasing liquor on Sundays.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named William who says, in the context of Indianapolis in the 1920s, landing the American Legion National Headquarters and building the Indiana World War Memorial Plaza was a big deal. Does the exhibit touch on this? Susanna, Rebecca, Carrie, any one of you.
The exhibition doesn't touch on this specifically because it really looks at prohibition as a national phenomena and does hit some of the major points, like some of the legal issues and figures like Billy Sunday here in Indiana. And we do also have a core installation in our permanent galleries that talks about specifically some of these related issues. I will say that certainly the American Legion was a player. They came out as pretty much on the dry side early on. And as I said, when the prohibition lost its legitimacy, again, the American Legion was one of those groups that was starting to slide away from that dry position and helped contribute to that debate that made the whole question of prohibition vulnerable.
What, in looking back on this, when we're talking about the fall of it, what was there a kind of a signal moment or a turning point that said, okay, this experiment, it's failed, and people had reached, or was it a much more gradual thing?
That's a tough question because there are any number of moments that are are posited as turning points, but it really was the accumulation, I think, of all of these. You know, there's some key congressional testimonies where the drives were just eviscerated. There was this group of society women, largely Republican, coming out, and actually the Republican Women's National Committee came out against prohibition toward the end of the period. So, you know, there were so many different points that people have alluded to, but it was really the weight of all of them coming together.
How long did it take to pull this exhibition together?
The National Constitution Center actually organized it, so I can't give you a lot of detail on that. It is a, but I know that they were working on it for several years. It was certainly in process at least 3-4 years ago, and it is touring nationally. And I will say that I had a chance to see it at the National Constitution Center when it first opened and was immediately struck by not only the breadth and the depth of it, but how much fun it is. You know, there are a lot of interactive experiences. There are about 100 artifacts. You really get pulled into this story. So many different experiences. Even the passage of the constitutional amendment is from this really wonderful carnivalesque machine, sort of like Terry Gilliam-esque, really, really fun approach. So,
what's your favorite part of it? I'm going to ask each of you that. What's your favorite part of the exhibition? Presumably, you've all seen it now. So, you know, the one thing that, and I'm assuming, and you, and please do not cheat and duck the question by saying, oh, the whole thing. Okay, but what is the thing that, oh, gave you that, oh, this is really cool moment? Suzanne, I'll start with you.
Well, I think the Wayne Wheeler's Amazing Amendment Machine, again, that I was just talking about, is probably my favorite because it takes Wayne Wheeler as this master political manipulator, putting through everything from the income tax amendment forward. And it just has so much fun showing you even the editing of the amendment down to the words that would actually get through Congress is done in a very entertaining way. I would say also there's an illuminating quiz on where you would have fallen on the wet-dry spectrum that is pretty surprising. So I'd encourage everybody who comes to take it because you might not land where you expect.
Carrie, the way you were shaking your head suggests that Susanna took yours, but go ahead.
I'll go with my runner-up.
All right.
I like the speakeasy.
You like the speakeasy?
I like the speakeasy, and I like that there's a door that you have to know the knock. And so that way you can gain access. But if you don't know the knock, you can go around. But once you get inside the speakeasy and then you get a chance to sit down, and yes, I have to confess that it's the roaring part of it, the fun, the party atmosphere.
That appeals to you. Yeah. Rebecca?
Well, I would say the exhibition as a whole, which you said we can't say, but I would also say that actually the way that we tie it into Indiana's history, so as Susanna alluded to, our permanent gallery, we've installed artifacts and stories about what was happening specifically in Indiana at this time. And so you will learn about women's suffrage in Indiana. You will learn about the Klan interaction in Indiana and also immigration and what kind of role that played, prohibition played for them.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Susanna Kerber, Rebecca Smith, and Carrie Miller, all of the Indiana State Museum. We've been talking about prohibition and American spirits. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.